Welcome to the last episode of Season 4 of the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. We'll be beginning Season 5 shortly, and it'll be a new focus. There's some new themes. We'll get some interesting guests coming your way throughout the year. But I decided to end this season with a look ahead to your new year. What are the things that are going to make this year great for you? I'm timing this episode not in late December or the first week of January, intentionally. I want to get it away from the noise that's typically around about New Year's resolutions. There's a lot of data that you've probably seen by now about New Year's resolutions and the failure rate. You might have a few that you've already started to wane about already yourself. This isn't about New Year's resolutions. This episode is a collection of short clips from guests we've had that can preview some tools that can make 2022 a great year for you. And not with resolutions, which tend to rely on willpower, but intentions, areas of focus, goals, things you really want in your life more in the new year ahead. You'll find the links to the full episodes in the show notes. So if something gets your attention or is highly relevant to you this year, or it's an episode you happen to miss, click on the link. It'll bring you right to the episode. So what if this year you could build the habits around things you want? What if you could make sure that your time was really invested in the things that matter most to you? What if you got the right amount of exercise on things that you really enjoy? What if you ate healthy, really healthy, and that also tasted good? What if you were kinder in your relationships with others? What if you spent more time in nature? What if you were happier? And finally, what if this year you could have more fun? To me, those sound like the ingredients to a recipe for a great year. And these guests have some methods and some practices and some research that can really help you get there. Our first clip is from our conversation with BJ Fogg, PhD. He's a behavior scientist and runs the Behavior Design Lab at Stanford. He's also the author of a book, Tiny Habits, The Small Changes That Change Everything. And his Tiny Habits method is very efficient, very easy to use fundamentally, although you got to refine it and tweak it. But it really helps get you there. And it's by starting small, really small. It's a method that I've been using personally since 2014. And I've been trained as a coach and use it in a lot of my coaching as well. So here's BJ Fogg talking about the Tiny Habits method and its three steps.
Well, behavior design is the phrase that at Stanford University we came up with to describe a new set of models about human behavior and how to design for it. And so behavior design is a pretty straightforward way of understanding what causes behavior and how you can change it, including habits. And that's really what Tiny Habits is all about. I map out, here's this thing called behavior design.
And you've invested over 20 years researching habit formation. Human behavior is obviously very complex, but your new book, Tiny Habits, lays it out in a very accessible and practical way. How would you explain the Fogg behavior model?
Well, the behavior model in some ways is the fundamental model of behavior design. And it came together for me in 2007. And this model, and it's really easy to understand, applies to all types of behaviors and all habits. It basically has three elements. There's motivation to do a behavior, the ability to do the behavior, and a prompt. And so any behavior will have motivation, ability, and a prompt. And this is what we discovered in research at Stanford and in industry work. And if you make a small tweak to any one of those elements, you can change a behavior. So for example, if you want to stop a habit, if you can remove the motivation, boom, it will stop. If you can't do that, can you remove ability, make it harder to do? You can stop it. Or can you remove the prompt? And you can also use the model for one-time behaviors, for creating habits, and so on. So it's this really pretty straightforward, I think elegant model that you can apply in a whole bunch of ways.
And one thing I notice is when we try to change our behavior, we often lean on motivation. So I'll psych myself up. Or willpower, I'll just gut it out. Why are motivation and willpower problematic?
Yeah, and you know, as you know, that's a big part of Tiny Habits, to say, look, people, Stop trying to rely on willpower to change. And guess what? Motivation is unreliable. Motivation shifts all the time. Like right now, it's just before lunch for me, or actually it's a little bit after lunchtime. But in an hour or maybe 2 hours after I've eaten, my motivation to eat will go down. So motivation is not a stable thing in our lives, and willpower can get tapped out. So motivation is just one component of the behavior model. So in Tiny Habits, it's about how do you make the behavior really easy to do? That's the ability factor. So you don't have to rely on motivation. And then what's going to prompt your behavior? So instead of obsessing with motivation or willpower, there's a better way to do it that's been road tested with over 40,000 people of making things really, really simple and tiny. And that's why it's called Tiny Habits.
So how will you invest your time this year? And how aligned will it be with the things you really want and your core values? The former CEO of Baxter International and current MBA professor at the Kellogg School and Northwestern University, Harry Kramer, shared with us how valuable and important reflection is to make sure that you're holding yourself accountable and investing your time in the way that you intend to.
I would say take a little bit of time. First, get off by yourself, turn off the noise, turn off the gadgets, and literally take a long walk, Joe, by yourself first, then maybe with a significant other, a spouse, whatever, and just start to ask those questions. What really are my values? What's my purpose? What matters? And however much time I have, am I living it in a way that I feel good about? And this may sound a little morbid, but you can tell, Joe, I'm a pretty positive guy. But there was a young woman once who said to me, well, how do you know whether you really feel this self-reflection has really impacted your life in a significant way? And this sounds a little crazy, but it's the way I think about it, Joe. If you and I are having this discussion right now, and all of a sudden, while we're talking, I get a phone call from my doctor. And he says, Harry, I just looked at your charts from yesterday, and I want to let you know right away, Harry, you've got 3 days. Now, you can start running around and go to places or, you know, Penn or Mayo, but you got 3 last days. And I tell the students, now, how would you react to that? I said, my sense is many, many people react, oh, no, whoa, I got to run around and I got to do all these things, whatever. And I said, the reaction I hope I have, Jim, I hope I have, is, well, thanks, doc, but I knew I had 3 last days. We all have 3 last days. So since you don't know when they are, why would you live any time as if, whether you get mad at people, well, did you apologize before you went to bed that night? Did you really think it through? Because this whole idea of, well, there'll be time later. Well, you know, they always say, you know, he will say, we don't know the time and the hour. Okay. So live your life the way you treat people, the way you interact with people, as if it was your last 3 days. And I think that will make an enormous difference in people's life, Joe. And then right after that, as we said, when you're starting to get your head around that, find some people who will really be honest with you. Hey, Joe, you're a really great guy, but you know, Joe, I'm a little surprised that you do this or you don't do this. And it's like, whoa. Yeah, no, that really is valuable. Thank you. That's valuable. That's the way I kind of think about it, John.
A great year is going to include a lot of physical movement. Exercise, as we know, is great for us. But our guest, Kelly McGonigal, the author of The Joy of Movement, expanded our ideas of what actually counts as exercise and creative ways that you can find what works best for you.
Well, there's one thing that happens almost universally. It's called the feel-better effect. And that's the fact that if you have been inactive, you've been sitting around, lying around, sedentary for any period of time, and then you begin to move your body. So you get your heart rate up a little bit, your blood is flowing to your muscles, you're breathing more deeply. Most people will immediately feel more energy and more positive. That's sort of how psychologists talk about mood. How much energy do you have and how positive or negative is your outlook? And no matter where you start out, you could start out low energy and negative, you know, depressed or bored or feeling a lack of hope, and getting active in any way tends to move you in that direction of feeling more energy and more positive. You could start out feeling really high energy and negative, like angry or anxious, and it somehow transforms that energy into a more positive source of energy that you can use. So that's called the feel better effect. And again, that seems to be the fact that simply you get a little boost of adrenaline, a little boost of dopamine in your brain, and people feel better when they're active. So that's like the low-hanging fruit. And again, it works no matter what your body, no matter what your physical ability, no matter what your age. It's what you can do in this moment, you know, to stand up, stretch, dance to a song in your living room, go for a walk around the block. And then there's much deeper effects, and we can talk about the science behind it or how it works. But we also know that in addition to that immediate feel better boost, that exercising on a regular basis profoundly transforms the brain, both how the brain works and also even the physical structure of your brain in ways that make you more resilient to stress and even more sensitive to positive emotions like love and gratitude and hope.
Eating right is important at any time of the year, but for most of us, it's top of mind at the beginning of each and every new year. We had the pleasure of speaking to John LaPuma, MD, who's a pioneer in the field of culinary medicine, which views food as a form of medicine. And he shared with us why it's so beneficial to eat right. And I can tell you from my own personal experience that following that podcast conversation 1 year ago, I've been following a number of his recipes. One in particular, I eat breakfast almost every day with a smoothie recipe. It's very healthy, but I can assure you it's also delicious and I can say addictive.
The CDC actually has addressed that, and they believe that 80% of heart disease and stroke and diabetes and 40% of cancer is preventable with lifestyle change. The CDC is about as conservative an institution in American medicine as exists. I think that almost all arthritis, particularly osteoarthritis, is preventable. I think that loss of mobility as we age is inevitable, but it doesn't have to decline quickly. Having major diseases become and being thought of as preventable problems that can be mitigated is really a game changer if what you're worried about is being sidelined by a critical illness that you don't have the ability to sway the course of. So having more control than you think means that you can make better choices and that they will matter. And after 50, almost all of aging is your choices. Before 50, your genetics have a lot to say. But as if you make it to 50, you can change your life if your habits haven't been good to not just improve your longevity, but improve your quality of life and, of course, your flexibility, your energy level, your curiosity, your cognitive alertness, your ability to communicate. There are a lot of amazing things you can do with lifestyle change.
So we know diet and exercise are keys in our health and well-being, but there's more. One of our guests, Kelly Harding, who's an MD and a master's in public health and the author of the book, The Rabbit Effect on the Mind-Body Connection, talked with us about the impact on health of how we treat other people, not just on them, but on us. And recently, as the pandemic has continued, it's having a toll, taking a toll on everyone. There's an article I read last week about anger and how it's increased at this stage of the pandemic and spilling over to how people are treating others, not only within families and working relationships, but restaurants, stores, service providers, etc. So maybe that's another element, another ingredient in crafting a great year this year. Kindness and how we're treating others.
Occasionally, people will misinterpret the message of the book to say, like, wonderful, I can just eat what I want now. But it would be nice to people. But I think the key thing is, you know, those things are important. But I guess here's the really shocking statistic is that we know that lifestyle factors are important. And we know that medical care and access to quality medical care is absolutely critical for every human being. But it probably only accounts, you know, for like medical care only accounts for about 10 to 20% of our overall health status. And the rest of it has to do with our social world and all these hidden factors in our homes, relationships, communities, workplaces, schools that we need to be talking and addressing that we often don't think about in as health. So the kale smoothie is certainly important, but I would also encourage you to share that have that kale smoothie with somebody that you care about. So I think that's the thing. Like, you look at sort of like blue zones or other areas where people live a long time. And the thing is, we get, as Americans, we often get quite focused on like the diet and, you know, what are they eating? How are they working out? But it's like, actually, you know, who are they eating with and who are they working out with? Because there's also this social connection component that unfortunately we're somewhat missing in many, we know from the loneliness data, we're really missing the boat on in a lot of our communities around the world and in our country. So for listeners, if there is one thing that you can invest in for your health, it's building positive relationships. And this pans out in multiple studies. And in fact, the longest running study ever, which has been done out of Harvard, shows that, you know, the number one predictor of somebody's health is actually positive relationships. So pay attention. You want to treat, just like we all, you know, think about exercise, diet, all those kale smoothies, we also want to think about, and as part of our health regimen, like, who are we hanging out with? Who are we connecting with on a daily or weekly basis? And do what we can to try to boost that.
Dr. Sanderson of Amherst College took us through the research on happiness and a lot of practical suggestions. One of them that you can start is spending more time in nature. It's good for us.
So I actually end my book in the very final section by talking about strategies. And it's my very favorite part of the book because I think it's so hopeful to know that happiness is within reach of all of us. Now, I also will point out that I don't think happiness is one size fits all. So sometimes people say, well, you know, I really don't like to meditate, or, you know, I don't like to exercise, or, you know, I don't like to read or whatever. And you know what? That's okay. Because happiness, I think, is very individual. But there are three very consistent findings in the literature, and I'm going to throw those out because these are things that just time and time again, empirical evidence, correlational, experimental, you know, descriptive, cross-cultural, et cetera, provide support for. Number one, spending time in nature. So as I'm talking to you right now, I'm actually looking out my office window and I'm looking at a little garden and some trees. I mean, I'm also looking at buildings, but I'm looking at the sky and I'm looking at nature. And I love this view because it really does force me to sort of look up. As I'm talking to you, I can see, if you were to turn around, you would see nature all around, right? I mean, you're clearly talking from a beautiful environment. I can see flowers, you know, right behind you and so on. So for many people, spending time in nature. And as this example that I just gave, you and I are not in nature as we're having a conversation, but we both have the opportunity to look at nature. So any kind of nature matters. It can be looking at nature. It can be being in nature. It can be actually having pictures around your office or your home or plants inside. It can be listening to audio tapes or CDs of birds chirping or waves crashing or whatever. But so things that put us in nature overwhelmingly increase psychological and physical well-being. Two, giving. And giving is so broad. Giving can be donating blood, donating bone marrow. It can be donating to charity, you know, financially. It can be spending time volunteering for an organization you care about. So giving is very broadly construed. I have a dear friend who is undergoing treatment for cancer right now. And yesterday she had another chemotherapy session. And what I'm doing is that every day on the day of her chemo, I'm sending flowers. So I had flowers delivered to her house yesterday. And it's a tiny little thing that I'm doing, but I'm doing it because it's a little tiny way of giving to somebody who's really undergoing a hard time. And so giving can mean lots of different things. It can mean flowers, you know, blood, time, you know, money, whatever. But giving is a very, very consistent way of finding happiness. And then the third thing, so nature is one, you know, giving is one. And the third thing, and this is true for all of us, relationships. Building and maintaining good relationships is so important for all of us. And this can be relationships with family members. It can be relationships with romantic partners. It can be relationships with colleagues. It can be relationships with neighbors. It can be relationships with friends. But the single best predictor of our happiness is building and maintaining good relationships. And we can all take steps to do that no matter who we are.
And there's one more thing you want to have on your list if you want to make it a great year. And that's taking time to have fun. Turns out, most of us need to work at this. It's not something that comes naturally as we move into adulthood. With busy lives and the pandemic, some of us have forgot. Science journalist Catherine Price, the author of the new book, The Power of Fun, joined us to talk about why it's important and to highlight why it's good for us.
There are so many. It was actually really astonishing. So I'd like to preface this by saying that fun itself should be its own reward. So fun feels good because it's fun. So there is that is worth something. But since all of us also want to have some other measure or reason to do stuff, there's a lot. I mean, some of the most powerful effects are the mental ones. The feeling of connection with other people is actually enormously important for our psychological well-being and also for our resilience. I wrote this book starting in April 2020, so really in the thick of lockdowns, and thinking about fun was a little interesting to do in the midst of the lockdowns, but it really helped me realize that having fun boosts your resilience. But there's a lot of physical effects, and I think that that's something that really hasn't been talked about or appreciated. So just as two examples, starting with connection, we think about human connection as something that feels good to us, but in reality, loneliness and isolation are physically very bad for us. There's been studies suggesting that the physical effects of loneliness and isolation are comparable to the effects of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Being lonely and isolated actually affects our bodies down to the level of our cells in terms of how our genes are expressed, which is really nuts if you think about it. In other words, which genes are turned on and off at what time. And that makes a big difference in terms of our disease risk. So being lonely and isolated actually increases your risk for physical disease to the point that one researcher whom I quote in my book referred to loneliness as a fertilizer for other diseases. So the fact that fun makes us connected to other people, to other creatures, you know, I think you can have fun with a dog, for example, to ourselves, that's actually very important for our physical health. And another physical benefit of fun is that it reduces our stress. Playfulness, connection, and flow all reduce stress levels. And anything that reduces stress levels will also reduce our cortisol levels. And cortisol is a stress hormone, really important if you're actually running away from something. But if you're facing an emotional threat or just everyday stress of the sort that we all have been experiencing quite severely for the past 2 years, that actually causes a lot of wear and tear on our bodies and will increase our risk over time for long-term health conditions ranging from heart attack and heart disease and stroke to even dementia and cancer. So anything that reduces our everyday stress actually has the potential to benefit us in the long run. So when you put all this together, I came to what I thought for me was a very surprising conclusion, that fun is actually an underappreciated or unacknowledged health intervention. And that far from being frivolous, prioritizing fun can actually be very good for your physical short and long-term health. I think that's kind of mind-blowing.
So how do you track how you're doing? How do you measure your progress throughout the year on these new intentions, new goals, or even old school resolutions? Well, neuroscientist Elizabeth Ricker, the author of Smarter Tomorrow, by the way, can be smarter tomorrow following a lot of her exercises in her book, Smarter Tomorrow, and we talked about them on our podcast. She has a method she uses. She starts at the beginning of each year to track how she's doing against the goals and resolutions she commits to.
I think, first of all, when most of us think about New Year's resolution, we have mixed feelings. So there's this burst of excitement at the beginning of the year, that there's all these things I want to do this year. It's going to be an amazing year. And then, you know, gyms tend to really benefit from this. They make lots of money in the first 2 months because everyone signs up for a new gym membership. And then oftentimes things don't look so good about 2 months later. So New Year's resolutions get kind of a bad rap because of this. So what I did is starting around 2011, I started to take more of a scientific approach. And I said, okay, I'm going to track my New Year's resolutions and I'm going to track my goals and I'm going to see how well this works out. And so I started doing that. I did that for a few years and I used a few different tools. I'd worked in tech, and so I was familiar with software management and project management strategies. So I used some of the tools that get used in companies. I used them on myself. I had an accountability buddy. I had a lot of different approaches that come from sort of the habit change literature. And I tried to use these things on myself. And that was interesting. But what I found a few years later was that something seemed to be missing. And it felt like I was accomplishing things and I was getting my to-dos done, but something felt a little hollow. So I was like, what can I add to this? So I came across the positive psychology literature. And there is this wealth of studies, research, thinking about what is happiness and how do we actually quantify that in a person? And it sounds so philosophical, but how do we actually tackle it in a scientific way? And it's a very long literature, but it sort of the most recent part starts in like the 70s. And so what I did is I adapted some tools that come from the literature, like Ed Diener is a very well-known legendary psychologist in this space. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is very, very well-known for flow. And there are a bunch of validated tools that are actually even available for free online that you can access yourself off of the UPenn Positive Psychology Center. So anyway, I took these tools and then I created a survey for myself that I called my life satisfaction scoring. So what I did going forward is I ran two tests in parallel. I tracked my say to do's, which was the things that I said I was going to do versus what I actually did, just sort of the standard productivity New Year's resolution type thing. But then I also tracked my life satisfaction scores. And the beauty of tracking both of these in parallel is that you start to see the weird disconnects. So oftentimes people say, oh, achievement or success can feel hollow. And that struck me as wrong, because it seemed like, well, if that's really the case, then probably you're not aiming for the right things. So I actually found that in my own data, that there were times when I was achieving quite a lot on my say-to-do scores, but my life satisfaction scores were lower. And then oddly enough, the opposite happens sometimes too. So what this taught me is that as you go through and you track yourself and you do these assessments, in the book I talk about exactly how to do this. You sit down with your accountability buddy, or you can do this on your own once a year, once a quarter, once a week, and even on a day-to-day basis, you can do these to-do list type approaches for say to do. And you do this tracking, but you also track your life satisfaction. And the point is to get better at creating goals that actually deliver satisfaction and happiness in your life. And I actually can testify that this does work, because my first 2 years were very jagged and I had huge disconnects between my life satisfaction and my say to do scores. And they have over time begun to correlate a lot more strongly with one another, which I feel happy about, obviously, but it also sort of shows that this is possible. So there are two big things that have happened in my life over the last 12 to 15 months, I guess you could say. And that is that my husband and I welcomed a little boy into our lives.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. So our little guy is now over a year old. And so I have a whole new set of goals that I am tracking associated with his health and well-being and happiness. And some of the goals around basically taking on a new role, which is being a parent, have been some of the most high satisfaction and also high say-to-do scores that I've enjoyed doing over the last 12 months. And then the other one that's kind of obvious is that I just finished this book, Smarter Tomorrow, and the process of learning how to do a book launch and how to sort of introduce ideas to a broad range of people has been really exciting and has sort of taught me how do you break down a big dream and into, you know, turning it into small milestones and quantifiable steps. So those have really been the two big things that I've been focused on this year. And so far, it's actually been going pretty well.
Well, I hope some of these ideas from our guests will inspire you to make this year one of your best ever. You'll find links to the full podcast conversations in the show notes. And if you'd like to browse all of our episodes across four seasons, visit our website at retirementwisdom.com. You can browse them at a glance, see topics and guests that may be of particular interest to you. Next week, I'll be back to kick off season 5 of the Retirement Wisdom podcast. You'll find some interesting approaches, some interesting guests coming up, and we look forward to hearing your feedback throughout the year. We appreciate you listening to the Retirement Wisdom podcast. Send us your suggestions, comments to my email, joec@retirementwisdom.com. Always love hearing from listeners, and we appreciate you taking the time to listen.